First case on the docket is Huber versus Colorado Mining Association, case number 10-SV-220. First thing I want to mention is that Justice Marquez will not participate in this matter, which I'm sure does not come as a surprise. And are both parties ready? Thank you. Argument is set for an hour, half an hour for each side. And you'll have to keep track of your time. Mr. Domenico, please start.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of the defendants. This case can be boiled down essentially to the following question. When the voters enacted Section 4 of Tabor, did they reveal an intent to reach back in time and undo statutes that had been on the books for years prior to Tabor's passage? Or instead, does Section 4 reveal an intent on the part of the voters to adopt a measure that reserved for them in the future the discretion to make changes in the law that increased taxes? The voters themselves told us the answer to that question in a part of Section 4 that the plaintiffs and the Court of Appeals failed to give any effect to. Section 4 begins by saying, starting November 4th, 1992, districts shall be required to get prior voter approval in order to do, and then it lists all the ways a district might choose or try to increase taxes. That reveals very clearly that Section 4 of Tabor is not retroactive, or to the extent it's retroactive only to November 4th, 1992. And it also reveals that Section 4 is about actions, discretionary decisions that previously would have been made by a district, but in the future can only be approved by the people. It is not meant to go back, as the Court of Appeals did, and undo statutes that were adopted in this case, 1988 or 1977. And the fundamental error the Court of Appeals made was in taking three words individually out of the center of Section 4 and looking at them individually rather than looking at them as part of Section 4 as a whole.
Can I stop you there, counsel? I take it you're moving from your retroactive argument to what a tax rate increase is. So I just want to stop you. Can you explain to me why you think this particular, whatever it is retroactive? Or is it somehow the Tabor's being retroactively applied here?
Sure. The reason is that Section 4, as the introductory language said, reveals, is about future decisions. It's not about undoing past decisions.
Well, is that about future taxes or future tax rate increases, not decisions?
It is about future actions that a district might take.
Okay, so I guess your argument is that since the actions that set this in motion, because they occurred before the magic date, it has to be it would be retroactive in this case.
In the words of Bolt, the majority, this tax was imposed in 1988. That's when the imposition of the tax took place. In the words of the dissent in Bolt, the tax was created in 1988. All that's being done after the date in Section 4. The only thing being done after that date is recalculating the numbers.
It's being applied every year. But being applied every year is not a tax rate increase.
It's not a Tabor event. It's not an increase. The tax rate is set by the statute. All that's being done by the department in this case is the purely ministerial act of looking at what the PPI is, recalculating it, and telling people what the result of their calculation is. There's no discretionary act. being taken.
Do you think there has to be a discretionary act for there to be a Tabor event?
I do think there does, and that's what Bolt is about. Bolt reveals that. In Bolt, the dispute between the dissent and the majority is really about when the last discretionary event took place. The majority finds that it was when the budget was adopted. The dissent says it was actually a later event when the county commissioners approved the budget. But everybody in that case agreed with the basic proposition that if the tax rate was set, the last decision setting a tax rate was before November 4th, 1992. Tabor does not require an additional vote. Whereas if the last decision that set a new number was after that date, Tabor would apply. That's precisely our position here. It's all about Section 4 is not simply about going back and trying to say certain types of taxes are not allowed. It's about taking discretion, as this court has said many times, it's about taking discretion to make changes in the law back from where it was prior to Tabor and giving it back to the people. That purpose is not served in this case by simply...
We've got some strange facts here, a delay of, what, almost 15 years, and then a rulemaking proceeding, and usually rulemaking is like policy-oriented, discretionary in nature. Having a little bit of concern why this isn't a change that triggers Tabor.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you that we have some strange facts here, and facts that... from our perspective are in some sense embarrassing. There was a mistake made by the department many years ago, and that led to 15 years of the statute not being enforced as it should have been.
Can I just tell you that it was a mistake that they thought they might be covered by Tabor, correct?
That's right. There was sort of, I guess, the best it appears from what we know, in 1993 there was a bit of a panic after Tabor. Everyone was unsure how it applied. And the department said, well, let's take a look at this. Let's stop while we figure this out. And then it, for whatever reason, took 15 years to actually take the careful look and figure it out. And I agree with you, Justice Hobbs, that is a strange fact, but it's not one that I think is legally relevant to the court.
Well, if it's ministerial, why is rulemaking required?
I'm not sure rulemaking necessarily was required. Rulemaking was used here simply as a method of allowing the public to know this was going to happen and as a method of allowing the plaintiffs and others to comment. But the question in front of this court is, can the statute be applied after Tabor or not? What happened administratively doesn't affect that question one way or the other. Either the mistake was made in 1993 or it was not a mistake at all. And in either case, the intervening 15 years don't reveal anything about that question.
Mr. Domenico, are you saying as far as the rulemaking is concerned, I mean, on its face, that would appear to be sort of discretionary action that you are referring to. But if I'm understanding your argument, it would be the rulemaking is irrelevant because it would be the same result with or without the rule.
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at Section 106, there's no rulemaking requirement, there's no discretion in it to apply this or not. It simply says the first sentence of Section 5 says the nominal rate is to be adjusted in a certain way, and the second sentence says the director of the department shall do these calculations. There's no discretion there. There's no requirement for rulemaking. The only reason there was a rulemaking this one time was because it was in recognition of the fact that there had been a 15 years of where the department had failed to do this, and the department, I think, felt it was the right thing to do to give public notice and let people comment on it and make their arguments. It doesn't imply, or it certainly can't create, their decision to do that doesn't turn a ministerial act into a discretionary act. There certainly can be rulemaking hearings that are ministerial, even required rulemakings that are still ministerial. Not every rulemaking, I don't think, implies a discretionary act. And more importantly, I think, Justice Hobbs, the plaintiff's argument is not that one time
event is the violation of Tabor. The plaintiff's argument and the result of the syllogism that the Court of Appeals says resolves the case, the result of that is every time the tax rate has to be adjusted pursuant to the formula. According to the plaintiffs, according to the Court of Appeals, every time that happens, Tabor is violated or you have to have a vote. But it doesn't matter, even if it doesn't, this one time event is irrelevant to the plaintiff's argument. Their argument is every time the number changes, Tabor is triggered. So I agree with you, those are unfortunate facts, but they really are legally irrelevant to either of our positions.
Mr. Domenico, could you give me a little more detail on why you think Bolt controls this case?
The decision in Bolt turned on each side looking at when was the last discretionary decision made by someone in the district. When did the district make a decision? In the majority's words, when did they impose the tax? In the dissent's word, it was either imposed or when was the tax created? The dispute there is over, the dissent says it was this later date that's after November 4th. The majority says it's before. Both of them agree that what matters is when was the last discretionary act. If the last discretionary act was before the date in Section 4 of Tabor, then both sides agree that Tabor is not triggered. If it's after, then both sides agree that Tabor is triggered. That's our position here. The plaintiff's argument in Bolt, the result was on one day in December of 1994, everyone agrees in Bolt. The number, if you plug the number into the syllogism of the Court of Appeals, in December, after the effective date of Tabor, that number changed. That number went up. If the Court of Appeals is right that a change in that number always triggers Tabor, no matter the reason it was adopted, no matter why or when the decision setting that number up, if the Court of Appeals is right that it doesn't matter why or when that decision was made, then Bolt is wrongly decided.
Could I interrupt you there? That didn't seem to be the way the Court of Appeals reasoned it, though. Isn't that right? Didn't they seem to see Bolt as different because it actually dealt with one tax change or tax increase, and the question it took to be resolved by Bolt was when was the decision made to make that tax change? And it seemed to distinguish this situation as one that didn't involve a particular tax change, but rather involved the adoption of a formula that would lead to future changes after the act clearly applied. Do you think that's a meaningless distinction?
I don't know if it's a meaningless distinction. I mean, the case obviously presents a slightly different question. But the fact of the matter is, if you used the Court of Appeals syllogism and applied it to Bolt, on one day after the effective date of Tabor, the number, the rate, changed. It went up 2 mils in terms of the ADA levy that is the main point of contention.
Let me just follow one time on that. But did the Court of Appeals seem to think that the debate was over when the tax rate change actually occurred? Did it occur at the time it was approved or at the time it actually took effect? And it seemed to me that the Court of Appeals was saying all we did in Bolt was say, well, the tax rate change occurs when it's approved. But we didn't say you can have a formula that, in effect, creates a tax changes after the act comes into effect.
I think that may be what the Court of Appeals was saying. But that undermines the entire proposition of the plaintiff's position and the Court of Appeals position. If what matters is when the decision was made, when the choice was made, when the tax was created, when it was imposed, no one would say that the department is imposing this tax. They're merely applying or creating it merely by recalculating the numbers as required.
The legislature can provide for a step up prior to
the the legislature imposed this tax as currently structured in 1988. The department, all it does is tells people what the result of that formula, the result of that choice is, which is no different essentially from what happened in Bolt. It's just that it happens more than once. In Bolt, something happened, the syllogism changed once after the effective date of Tabor.
Well, how does that differ from local districts increasing the mill levy? Well, local districts that increase the mill levy.
Right.
Have to get a vote, right? So
they do. And if take this example, if there's a molybdenum severance tax that is a flat 5 cents a ton, I think, rate. If the legislature decided we need to index that for inflation today, we need to add a provision like Section 5 of the coal severance tax today, we all agree that would require a vote. But that one-time vote, our position is that one-time vote approving the formula that would index that severance tax for inflation suffices to approve every future result of the formula. You wouldn't need a new vote just because this would happen again and again. So
you're saying basically, fundamentally, you're saying if it doesn't increase, if the proportion, the percentage doesn't increase, it's fine because you follow a formula, even though it may result in a tax increase, right?
That's right. The fundamental purpose of Section 4 is to restrain governmental discretion to make changes in the law. That's what the Blue Book says. Votes are required for future changes that raise taxes. It doesn't say that this is meant to eliminate certain types of taxes because they might include an automatic adjustment formula.
Mr. Domenico, so what you're saying basically is that the formula itself is the tax. Is that right? And any change in the formula would be changing the tax, but until there's a change in the formula, there's no change in the tax.
That's exactly right, Justice. If you consider our position is that you could reformulate these by doing some fairly simple algebra, taking $40 a ton, which is, I think, about an average sales price. You could rewrite this as a revenue-neutral measure by redoing the math. I think 54 cents a ton works out to about 1.33% of $40.
I understand that. I just had this question about how then, during these public hearings, the agency action, what if any discussion was there about the formula? Was there none? And was the discussion only, we're going to start this up again? Or how did that all happen?
There was discussion both in the hearings, and one of the questions that was asked of the Attorney General for the formal opinion was how the formula precisely worked, because it's a little bit confusing the way the formula is written. It requires the department, the way the tax works is not that you can just set the rate. There was some question about could you just go 54 and
well,
then
I guess here's my question. Is it just math or is it somewhat more than math?
The formula?
Yeah.
The formula is purely math.
Okay.
And there was some question, was there any room in there to make an adjustment, and everybody's conclusion was no. And I don't think the plaintiffs dispute that the statute, if it's lawful, doesn't leave room for that sort of discretion. It leads to one number, whether the department calculates it or not. So there's no room in the statute for.
So the discussion was at the administrative hearing?
The discussion at the administrative hearing was largely the same discussion we're having here, a legal dispute between the plaintiffs and others and the department, and of course some policy discussion about the burdens this would impose that no one necessarily disagrees with. It's just simply, if the statute is lawful, the department has to enforce it as written. If it's unlawful, if the plaintiffs are right and it's unconstitutional,
then it can't be enforced. And I think that intervening 15 years is unfortunate. I mean, it's certainly unfortunate whether the department is correct or incorrect. It's unfortunate, because if we're incorrect, that means there was some 15 to 20 million dollars that should have been collected that weren't.
Now, Tabor had a bunch of moving parts. Part of it was a dollar increase to a certain cap, and then it had to be remitted right to the taxpayers if it exceeded that cap. So does that play into this, that section of Tabor play into this analysis or not?
I think the only way it plays into this analysis is it reveals that that is more the more sensible place to look when you think about what is the meaning of this supersedes language, supersedes conflicting or contrary provisions. It doesn't, I don't think that provision gives us any guidance to interpreting Section 4 itself. But it does, I think, those are the types of things where the superseding language can be important, that you can have a law that's in place, but if you bump up against the Tabor cap, that's it, you have to stop there. So I think Section 4 itself guides the fundamental question here, and those provisions are, I don't think, help us on that.
I follow up on your formula. I'm sure your opposing counsel is going to stand up and give you this example, so I'm just hoping you can address it. This year we have a 10% income tax, and next year the legislature decides that it's going to be 11%. So obviously the tax rate has gone up, and how does that differ? I mean, how does the formula, just help me understand how the formula makes a difference, because obviously in your case you're going to go from 10% to 11% or whatever. Similarly, the actual number is going to change. Help me understand your argument that the fact that it's the product of a formula makes the difference.
When you think about a percent is a number divided by 100. It's itself a simple formula, but a formula nonetheless. If the legislature says we need to go from 10% to 11%, that choice is a discretionary choice that the people in Section 4 if it's made today, requires a vote. That decision.
So it's your discretionary argument. I mean, both for retroactivity and the formula.
Well, that would be a change in the formula. That would be both a change in the number and a change in the formula. Actually, probably was a mistake to try to introduce some algebra into this, but if you do the math, this, as a percentage of sales, actually goes down over time, the current tax, even if you apply the adjustments, because it only matches changes in the inflation 1.5 to 1. So it doesn't even keep up with inflation. So actually, it's over time, this tax in real terms goes down, whereas a percentage of sales tax will generally track inflation. I hope that responded.
Could I ask one more question about the discretion? It seems a little bit of a slippery concept. This was obviously done by statute. So if at some point in time, as happened over the last 15 years, but for a different reason, the legislature decided to modify the formula, but only for a particular year. In the year 2011, we're going to pass a statute that says we won't collect this formula. When we came to 2012, would that then be a change, even though the formula simply kicks in again because it was passed before the before Tabor?
That's a very good question. My view is, I think, as long as the one-time change was only downward, leaving it in place otherwise, the rest of the statute probably would not trigger it. I don't think you need to answer such a difficult question to resolve.
And I didn't mean to just try to come up with something cute, for you. Part of the reason I was thinking of that is it deceptive to say there's no discretion if that could be done?
Well, I think no one's exercising discretion to raise the existing tax rate in that case. Well, at least that would be the argument. This is not that difficult
a case, I think. It's clear that what the statute said. It's put in place the law. No one's making any decision. The question is just, can you continue applying a law that long predates Tabor or not? And if I can, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay.
Good morning. Paul Seavey on behalf of taxpayer respondents and the Colorado Mining Association. With me at council table is Marion Larson, and I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
Did you get rebuttal?
Okay. I'll carry on. Respondents are coal mining companies involved in the exploration, production, and development of coal resources in Colorado. All pay a severance tax on coal, and all are members of the Colorado Mining Association. The Court of Appeals below properly found the challenged Department of Revenue regulation and its attendant 40% increase in the coal severance tax rate to be precluded under Tabor because it was not first preceded by a voter approval.
What's that 40% based on?
It was 40%, Justice Hobbs, over the rate at the time it was frozen.
Okay, so that takes into account the 15 years adjustment. I'm not getting why
it wasn't 40% of the rate. It's the result was 40% higher, right?
That, yes.
Yeah, I don't think you mean rate.
It was 40% above the rate that it was when it was frozen.
No, not rate. The number that you had to pay was higher. More dollars.
30% 30% more dollars.
That's what you're trying to say.
Rate is different.
Yeah.
That's rate is a percentage.
That's right. The state before you attacks the simplicity of the Court of Appeals analysis of these issues. However, this is a simple case. It's also a narrow case. This case is about giving meaning and effect to both Tabor Section 4A's provisions that are very plainly stated, requiring voter approval before any district can increase tax rates. Similarly, Tabor Section 20, paren 1, quote, supersedes conflicting state constitutional, state statutory charter, or others local provisions. We have an instance of superseding, not repealing, but superseding the application of the coal severance tax statute. The Department of Revenue saw these things correctly right after the adoption of Tabor. In 1993, the department made a reasoned written determination, which was reaffirmed in 1998. And for 14 years thereafter, the department correctly interpreted Tabor and its duties under Tabor by freezing the upper rate of the coal severance tax rate at 54 cents per ton.
So you're arguing there we should defer to the agency's prior interpretation? I mean, this is purely an issue of law, isn't it?
Absolutely, Justice Hobbs. I'm pointing out that contemporaneous with the constitutional amendment, the agency got it right in reading the nature and effect of it, and that is a fact of this case. Independently, it's a legal issue, but certainly it happened, and we believe they did it right. Thus, affirming the Court of Appeals decision would not involve charting new territory, but rather maintain Tabor's simple mandate, no new tax rate increases without voter approval.
Let me just sort of follow up on what you just said to Justice Hobbs, excuse me, and that is, would it therefore follow that what the department did in both in you know, freezing it initially and then in making the rule change, which sort of reverse their action, but that's all irrelevant, that the issue remains whether that formula is a tax rate or whether the amount instead is the tax, or the amount per ton is the tax rate.
I wouldn't, Justice Martinez, I wouldn't say it's irrelevant. It's an analog to the issue that they've raised that said, oh, shoot, we just made a mistake. And I'm wanting to point out, no, they didn't make a mistake, because they made a very reasoned assessment. If you look at the two instances where...
But if you agree with... if your answer to Justice Hobbs was that you weren't arguing that their decision in freezing had any effect, that you were saying instead you were simply arguing that it coincidentally happens to be they were correct in that decision. And that's consistent with your view of Tabor that you're arguing today. If that's the case, then why aren't the subsequent actions not pertinent to the legal argument, to the legal issue before us?
Well, I think they're very much related, Justice Martinez. It is an interesting historical fact that they got it right, and that's important. We're not asking you to defer to that, But it happened at the time when they did what the Constitution required as amended in 1992, effective in 93. And that is freeze the right of the coal severance tax. And the mechanism that allowed upward adjustments to the formula was frozen by virtue and the application of the Constitution. And so that instance is legally relevant here. The department got it right.
It's interesting. Is that kind of an implied repeal of a legislative action? I mean, this is a Republican form of government. The legislature was not constrained by Tabor. The people changed it. I'm having trouble focusing on this. Well, repealed a legislative action, basically? Tabor repealed it?
Well, we're not repeal. I mean, the repeal is mentioned in Tabor, but so is supersedes. And our position is that the application of Tabor to the coal severance tax statute and the formula therein superseded the manner in which it could be applied prospectively. And at the time of Tabor's application, as the department recognized, it resulted in and required the department to freeze upward adjustments. So at that point of Tabor's applicability, it was 54 cents per ton.
Stevie, I understand your, I mean, it's good background information. It adds to your pile. But I think we should go directly to the argument that Mr. Domenico is raising. As I see it, it really involves the application of a case we did in 1995, much later, Bolt. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'd like to hear your position and why. I mean, I think you do an excellent job in the brief about it's not a formula and so forth. I guess his argument does make some sense that the percentage has not been changed. And that was a legislative decision, you know, under Section 4, which predated the constitutional amendment. So I guess I want to hear your position on that.
Absolutely, Mr. Chief Justice. With respect to Bolt, the argument as we understand it is that both the Attorney General's opinion 2007-1 as well as in the briefs in the court below and in this court is that defense of the unlawful tax rate increase is tied to an argument that Bolt and now Campbell somehow exempt pre-Tabor tax schemes. And the facts of Bolt just don't bear that out, nor does this court's holding in that case. And the facts are that the tax levy in Bolt was constitutional because this court found it to have been imposed prior to the enactment of Tabor's voter requirements. And in that case, the district merely met after Tabor's passage to set the mill levy in accordance with what the voters had already approved. And this court found that another election to approve the same mill levy rate wasn't necessary because the voters had already approved it. That is not the circumstance here.
So the distinguishing fact you're basing your point on is that there was a voter election in 19, I forget the dates, but prior to the passage of Tabor, right?
That's right.
Okay. But what about his theory about the discretion? There was no change in discretion. You can read that case. That's certainly in that case. So how about that?
Well, to that I would say that Bolt also clearly provides that Tabor applies to new or increased taxes imposed after the November 4, 1992 date. And so
I think his argument is on the basis of Bolt is that the only discretionary act occurred before that. And that was in the legislative decision to make the percentage, really.
Okay, and I understand that. The post-Tabor, the department in its volition is taking an external factor and using it in the formula, and the product of their actions is to raise the tax rate.
So the external factor you're talking about is the
producer price index.
The PPI.
Yeah, and so they are taking a direct action to rely upon data outside the control and influence of the taxpayer to result in state action that raises
How would the taxpayer ever have control or influence over that kind of data, or even any kind of voting authority over that kind of data?
They don't, Justice Rice.
What I always think of when I think of this formula is just that there is certain data which is external to the formula, but then it's just plugging in numbers thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And the formula is what determines the ultimate
the solution, I guess, or the tax rate, but that the data is, of course, variable, and there's nothing anybody can really do about it. It's just what it is. It's totally external to all of us in any voting, for sure.
Everything you said, I agree with 100%, but the consequence is, in the Tabor world, is it results in, and it is the sole cause of, a tax rate increase.
See, his argument, I mean, I don't think he disagrees with that, except that he says
that.
Well, no. I don't want to speak for him, but he's going to say it might result in the taxpayer paying more money because of an increase to that person, but it was imposed by the legislature pre-Tabor under Section 4. So therefore, it doesn't constitute a Tabor tax increase. That's as I see his argument.
And that's where we differ.
Okay.
I could understand, for example, this is what I'm having trouble with. If the way you weigh that data, that external data, changes, or the importance or the effect that you give to that data, then that of course would be a change. But if it's just data, which is always treated, which may or may not change, which is always treated the same, however, in terms of the formula, that just doesn't seem like a change to me.
Well, it is a change, and it's a change.
But not a change over which the voters can have any influence ever. I mean, they can never say, we're going to vote on whether the PPI can go up or go down.
But I think this court's jurisprudence in Tabor, in the Bickel case and in Bolt, both say that the voters have to know what they're approving. And because these tax rate increases are occurring at the hands of the department, there is state action with the Department of Revenue increasing the tax rate. I mean, the formula is not the tax rate. The tax rate is a product.
But the PPI isn't the tax rate either. I mean, one has to determine how to come up with a tax that's fair, and one would look at factors and then apply percentages or whatever mill levies to those factors.
So the PPI, just in terms of the fairness argument, the PPI is a national index.
Sure.
And it's an aggregate index.
But it's nothing the voters have any control over.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I just happen to think legally that doesn't matter.
Sure. I guess I understand your position, but thank you.
So I just this concept that the tax rate is the product of the formula and not the formula itself is substantiated by the department's regulation talking about adjustments to the rate based upon changes to the PPI. The statute, the 1977 statute, affirms that position, and then the department's own chart posted on its website talks about changes in the tax rates and those things. Those numbers have changed substantially. Today, the department calculates.
You see, with your argument, I mean, there's an aspect of this which is sort of just semantics, because you can call various aspects of this the tax rate. And I guess I would kind of like to point that out, or to hear what you would respond to. In terms of, would your argument really change at all if that hadn't been referred to as the rate occasionally? I mean, does it really matter if the rate is defined in words one way or the other, or should we instead be looking at the effect of this?
I think you look at both, Justice Martinez, and I think this court's decision in the Bruce case supplied that practical test for measuring what is a tax rate increase. Now, we recognize Bruce was, with respect to Section 3 of Tabor and the election process, but it has no different meaning here substantively when it's applied to the taxpayer. I know it when I feel it. I mean, I write a larger check, it's a tax increase. That's exactly what's happening.
Well, but I mean, a lot of taxes are based on a percentage of value, and value increases, and so the tax paid increases corresponding to inflation. Here, and maybe some others, but here, instead of taxing a value, they've taxed a quantity. And then they have, it seems to me, made the necessary measures to have some adjustment for value, albeit only at a sort of two-thirds rate. So it's a different mechanism to achieve a similar sort of result, which is that the effect is a percentage of value, albeit decreasing over the years in this case. Isn't that true?
No, Justice Martinez, okay. I respectfully disagree with
you. Explain to me, please.
Sure. This is a tax that is based upon a rate that's outside of the control of the taxpayer. That's different than the four taxes the court or the state has raised to be imperiled now by the Court of Appeals decision. All of those.
Well, I mean, you mean it's out of control because it was set before the enactment of Taylor.
Several things, if I can just get these points out. They were set before Taylor, and the rates were defined, and the rates don't change by virtue of the taxpayer status. They are an established set of rates and do not vary. They don't have formulas like the one we have here, and they don't increase post-Taylor. And that's dramatically different than the statute and the rule that you have before you in this case, dramatically. That's what makes this tax unique. The other thing I'll say is that the circumstance we have here was recognized by an Attorney General opinion, 93-3, in terms of the substance of this. The Attorney General's opinion to an agency there stated that voter approval is required when there's increases in the standard or computed rates. That's what we have here. We have the computed rates increasing by virtue of the state looking at an external factor that is unrelated to the coal producers. It's a national aggregate average index that is all of the producer price goods cost in the United States. It's a huge macro index. Back to what kind of formula is acceptable or isn't acceptable. This one is not acceptable because it allows post-Taber the rates to increase without voter knowledge or approval. And as I indicated, we read this court's decision in Bickel to require informed and vote for that matter to require informed voter elections. They have to know
if the voters pass this sort of formulaic rate, that increases. Would they have to reapprove it every year, or you'd say no simply because it doesn't violate the voter approval, even though it increases as a matter of law every year?
A formula like the one we have could pass constitutional muster if it had a discernible, articulated bookend. That's I use the silly phrase, the Bickel bookends. Bickel requires the voter to know and authorize the extent of the tax to which they be asked to be paid. So they have to authorize the starting rate or amount, but in order for it to pass Taber, they have to authorize the other bookend as well.
There's no bookend on this one, is there? There's no bookend on this one, is there?
No.
Okay. So in your view, the voters could not pass this particular tax without approving it every single year. Is that correct?
Well, they couldn't pass this particular tax.
Well, because it would only be in effect for 1 year, and then it would be subject to a Taber challenge the following year.
Sure, if you kept it written that way. That's right.
So Taber does prevent.
The tax rate cannot adjust on its own, independent on an open-ended index, without the voter's authorization.
So in your view, Taber does prevent this type of tax, regardless of whether the voters or the legislature approves it.
That's correct. So in closing, I would ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, reasoned decision, and determination that the Department of Revenue's regulation imposes a tax rate increase that occurred in the absence of first having voter approval, and then as a consequence set aside that rulemaking and declare that under Taber, the tax rate cannot exceed 54 cents per ton. Thank you very much.
I think we can all agree we wish that taxes and tax law were as simple as the plaintiffs claim they are. But in practice, the concept of taxes and tax rates and the way taxes are structured is actually quite complex. And when we refer to a tax rate, we can refer to any number of different things, not any number, but a number of different things, depending on the context. So take, for example, if I ask 10 people on the street, what's your income tax rate? they may come up with 10 different things. If someone makes $100,000, wrote a check for $20,000, they might say, well, my income tax rate is 20%. Or they might say, well, my marginal tax rate was 33%. Or they might say, well, my adjusted gross income was $80,000, so that's 25%. All those are things we would call a tax rate. The question in this case is, what is the tax rate increase that the voters had in mind when they adopted Section 4 of Tabor? And it's clear that it's not just the syllogism that if the number goes up, that that automatically qualifies as a Section 4 tax rate increase that requires voter approval. To do so, as Justice Martinez's questions showed, turns Tabor, which was meant as a measure to expand the authority and discretion of the voters, into something that is actually a substantive limit on what the people themselves can do. There's absolutely no evidence in any case or in any of the text or context of Tabor, Section 4 of Tabor at least, that it was meant as a substantive limit. There are, I think, in Section 7 and maybe some other places, some substantive limits. Section 4 is a procedural matter only that is meant to say that what could have been done before by a vote of both houses of the General Assembly and the signature of the governor, and there's no dispute that this law was lawful before Tabor. All Tabor says is after Tabor, to do the same thing, we the people have a check on that discretion. So the ultimate upshot of the plaintiff's argument is Tabor is now a limit on what the people can do, not something that grants them more power. And I think that a couple of quick points to hit on. There is no volitional act on the part of anyone in enforcing this law. If the law complies with Tabor, it has to be enforced. It is taxes go up not because of any choice made by the department. Taxes, to the extent they go up because inflation goes up. The people cannot vote on whether to approve of inflation or not. Regarding Attorney General Opinion 93-3, I think that actually, I encourage the court to read it. It, if anything, is very supportive of our position, which is that if you change the inputs into the formula in a way that increases the effective rate, that does require voter approval. But simply applying an existing formula does not.
What's the practical effect of your argument? Do the companies have to pay 15 years back?
Your Honor, the department has not sought back taxes. There's a three-year statute of limitations for one thing, so there would be no ability to go back past a certain date. And so they have not sought that. They've only, the rulemaking was just saying we're going to start going forward in the future, applying the statute as written.
Are they precluded? I mean, for the 3 years? No.
I don't see anything that necessarily legally precludes it. It was sort of a mea culpa that this was a mistake and we're not going to try.
So it's prospective from the time of the rulemaking?
That's right. I believe that it was, it went into place in January 2008 is when the new numbers went into, when they said we're going to start enforcing it now. If there aren't any further questions.
I actually have one more, I'm sorry. Can you just briefly describe to me what the connection between your retroactivity argument is and the tax rate increase argument? I mean, are those independent? I mean, isn't it, if it's not a tax rate increase, we don't care about retroactivity? Or,
well, I think
help me understand
they're
that.
They're not necessarily independent of each other. You can, there are, I think, different ways of saying a similar thing. A tax, Section 4 of Tabor is about looking forward, imposing a new procedural obligation on decisions. It's not about going backward. And so the tax rate increase has to have been a decision made after Tabor was in effect. It only applies to things that would require a vote after that date. So if you're going to say that any formula that imposes a new, that leads to a new number, a new increase in the tax burden violates Section 4, then you're effectively making it retroactive, because there are a few statutes, including this one, that predate Tabor that the plaintiffs would undo. And so I think they're related to each other. There are just two ways of looking at sort of the same proposition, which is Section 4 is not meant to go backwards and undo existing law. It's meant, as the Blue Book said, to deal with how to make future changes in the law that increase taxes. Inflation is what increases this tax to the extent it increases, not any change in the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Court wants to thank both parties for their arguments. The case will be submitted on the briefs, and we'll